note to listeners, due to a scheduling snafu, this interview starts off with both me and Gabby, and then Gabby disappears.
And then I go conduct another interview by myself until Allison shows up at the end. So these next 2 weeks, what a ride we're on.
What a ride. But you know what? We made it work and we got the content. And here's your content, people. Here's your con. What does Bo Burnham say? I made you your content. Just between us. Hey!
Just between us. Hey! Hello, I'm Allison Raskin. I'm a writer, mental health advocate, and officially on summer vacation from grad school.
Hi, I'm Gabby Dunn. I'm a writer, bicon, bisexual icon, wink, and mediocre at TikTok.
Tell me more.
No, that's it. I don't know what it's supposed to be for anymore, so I'm over it. But you're done with grad school for the summer?
I get August off, which is very thrilling for me.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to New York for a week, and mostly I'm just not going to have to sit on Zoom for hours every few days.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the Delta variant's screwing everything up, but was there a time where you were going to have to go back to grad school in person?
Yeah, the plan is to go back for the next quarter, both for Pepperdine, where I go as a student, and for USC, where I go as a teacher. So as of right now, both campuses are planning on doing in person in September. So we shall see.
Well, good luck to you.
Have a good one. See you later.
hope that works out for you. Do you think that you would be a better teacher in person?
I would hope so.
Because it's hard over Zoom, right?
Yeah, it's really hard. Well, I've been on break from teaching for a while now because USC has like a true 3 month summer versus Pepperdine where it's like one month. But yeah, I mean, I would hope. I mean, also just like as a student, it's like nobody in my classes talk. So the
really?
Professor will just be like, ask a question and no one will reply. And then it's like, I could reply, but I'm like, I don't want to be the person answering every question.
So then nobody says anything?
A lot of the time that happens, yeah. It's really uncomfortable.
And can she call on someone?
He doesn't do that, no. I mean, I was in person for such little time. I was only in person for maybe like 2.5 months.
Right.
And so I'm hoping that like it'll be a little more dynamic when we go back in person. But even like in person, I mean, people just don't talk. And it's like it really like makes the class like worse.
Because do you think people are just scared to say the wrong thing?
Yeah, or they don't know what to. I mean, sometimes he'll ask a question. I'll be like, I have no idea. But other times I'll be like, oh, I have something to say, but I've already said too much in this class.
Well, I think like in high school, it feels like, okay, like I'll speak up in the class or whatever. But maybe in like grad school, people just don't know if they should, or like we've got some sort of like new adult social anxiety that like we didn't have in high school.
I don't know. I mean, when I was teaching too, it was like he would ask things and no one would reply. So it's really
awkward. I'm just imagining this. It's so awkward.
It's so awkward. But the thing about the Zoom situation is like, you know, it's in a way less awkward because it's like everyone's in their own room. So like maybe you don't feel the pressure as much to be the one to talk.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping like in person we'll all like make eye contact and be like, hey, maybe you could say something.
It's so awkward. Wow. Well, this is Just Between Us, a variety show filled with heartfelt advice,
ridiculous games,
and brutal, brutal honesty. Oh, no.
I know. It's rough. Also, just like I'm really worried about the type of people that seem to want to be therapists. But that's a whole other topic for another day.
You're like seeing them as their real selves and you're like, I can't believe this person is going to be someone's therapist.
I have some concerns about worldviews.
Oh, no.
I have some concerns about worldviews. I have some concerns about vibes.
Well, because you think that they would not be a very good therapist.
I mean, look, in terms of like personality, like who am I to say? But I think in terms of like worldviews, like therapy is social justice. And if you don't have, you know, like progressive leanings and a progressive view of the world, like it's, this isn't really the right, this, like if you don't think that people are oppressed, you shouldn't be a therapist.
Yeah.
Like, wow. You know, like there's some stuff where I'm like, you know, like, oh, you don't, you're not a feminist? Oh, okay. Don't, please don't be a therapist.
Or be a therapist for a very specific subset of person, I guess.
Well, no, because then you would never be able to acknowledge sex, right, that sexism exists, right, in a way. Do you know? Like, you have, yeah, like, so much of it is like, also doing social justice stuff, mm-hmm, and like if you don't even like believe in social justice, that's like a very weird way to be entering the therapeutic helping field.
I want a shirt that says I'm concerned about vibes. Just a mug that's like, I have, what was it, like, I have some concerns about vibes, I have, I'm concerned about .. vibes.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's very uplifting. This week we're going to be asking Olayami Olorun some tough questions about being a public defender.
And later we'll be discussing Bennifer and the obsession with celebrity relationships. But before we can get to all of that, it's time to answer a listener's question. Hit it! International question! International question! Alma, Austria.
She, her. And I love that name. Alma's such a cute name.
It really is. And I've been to Austria, so pretty cool. Oh no, I'm in a silly mood. All right. TLDR. How do you maintain a good relationship with your own creative process in the age of Instagram and the pressure to go viral?
Oh no.
Oh, no. I wish I knew.
Here we go.
Dear Allison and Gabby, I've always wondered which question I'll ask you. Now the day has come.
Wow.
I'm a 22-year-old student, almost finished with my bachelor in theories of film, theater, and media. I've always dreamt of becoming an artist, directing, making music, designing fashion, writing a book, and jumped from one creative passion to another, and always have 1,000 ideas at once. Cool. It is difficult for me to stay consistent and focus on only one project. I suffer from self-doubt and enormous pressure to be successful, a wish to become famous, and I guess be special, and therapy to work on this.
Sure.
Apart from that, it just seems like a wonderful way to spend your life, creating and working with other creative minds. These days, I find myself scrolling through Instagram and watching other people's art, which pressures me as I feel I am nowhere with my career. Right now, I'm really confused how to go forward. A part of me wants to conquer Instagram, learn about the algorithm and get a following to have something to be proud of, find a community. But then I get disappointed easily about only having 60 followers and expect to grow overnight and have the urge to just quit. I wonder if I should just take myself out of this race as I am not enjoying it most of the time. Also, the goal shouldn't be to make art for Instagram, YouTube, but what do you do with the wish to be seen? So I wonder, how do you maintain a good relationship with your own creative process in the age of Instagram pressure to go viral? Do I even need to be on there? I'm a big all or nothing person. The thought to quit art and do something else, studying psychology, and the sudden urge to create, go to art school, are ripping me apart. It would be really nice to make a decision or to have another outlook because this is exhausting. But also, quitting would be like giving up before even starting. How do you know when to push through all this self-doubt and pursue the dream to be an artist? And when does it become toxic and would be better to change career plans and see it as a hobby? I would love to hear your thoughts on this as I don't have people in my life who can relate or are in an artistic field. A big thank you for your consistent vulnerability, brutal honesty, and thoughtful advice. I have so much respect and love for you and wish you all the best. Have you been, like, listening in on my therapy sessions?
Okay, so here's the thing. Social media is bad.
I don't agree with you on that, but that's something we disagree about, but okay.
Going viral is a double-edged sword because going viral is not something that you can control. So, like, if you go viral for something good, it's all... I've seen that happen maybe 3 times. But if you go viral for something bad and everybody is, like, dunking on you and, like, knows who you are for a bad reason, like, that happen... I see that happen, like, way more. And I think the idea of going viral is seen as positive in a way that it no longer is. It's hard because I you're right about not creating for Instagram or for YouTube specifically, right? Like, I think it's all gotten so warped, and like, if it doesn't make you feel good, don't do it. Like, I went off Twitter, and I have been considering like being on Instagram as much, because I realized that once I left Twitter, I had so much more time to actually write. I had so much more time to actually do my work. Like, I feel like doing the art is its own thing, and then going on Instagram to promote the art or to put up stuff from the art is secondary. Like, you have to be doing the stuff in order to then promote it on Instagram, and not the other way around. I feel like starting from the place of Instagram is like the wrong move, because I wasn't making anything worth posting about when I was just worried about posting.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like my creative process, like I picked this question because this is something I have been grappling with a lot, where I feel like I am out of content that I feel like, you know, I'm very aware that I came up on the internet. The reason that I've had the career success that I've had is because of a large part because I was able to build a following online. And I think that there is a lot of power in that, you know, having gone to like to film school and tried to go the traditional route as being a screenwriter, and that like nothing happening for me until I had a YouTube channel, you know, mm-hmm. like I think that it makes a lot of sense that you do put time and thought into the social media of it all. But I, you know, for me, I'm like reaching this point where like, and you know, I see people being so creative all of the time, especially on TikTok, and see people's tweets do so well all of the time. And I'm constantly like, I don't have anything left to say.
That's the problem. If you get off of that stuff, if you stop like comparing or going, you know, into that stuff.
But there's also the reality of the fact that like I have a book coming out next year, and I have to maintain my fan base. I have to maintain my visibility so that stuff does do well.
But you have to work backwards from that. You have to have like the book, and then you have to like work backwards from the book to promote the book. Like you going on TikTok or going on Twitter and saying, oh, well, compared to these people, I don't have any ideas left, is bullshit. You absolutely have ideas left. Like you're just like going on these things and thinking, oh, well, that person did it better, so why bother? Or that person like.
That's just, I don't think, I think you're putting words in my mouth.
But like, you're not, but you do have ideas. You
well, not do really have- though. Like I, you know, I'm trying to do more TikToks, and I don't have ideas. Like I think about this like all day, every day. Like this has been a thing that I've been dealing with, where like I just don't have, I, you know, like we used to make a sketch a week, and like we used to put up two videos a week, and like I am in this place where I feel really drained, and like I feel like I don't have ideas, and I don't have ideas for TikTok videos, and it is like distressing to me, and like that's my truth.
But then why do it? Why not just get rid of all of that stuff for now and like sit down and focus on like doing something that is real?
Because that's also my business. So I can't just abandon the social element. Like I don't have as many projects going on as you do right now. Like I don't have my next thing. And so I have to maintain this fan base in order for me to continue my career. And I think when you treat me like that, that's not true. And that's not a reality of life. Like that, I feel very unheard. And I feel like it's hard for me to talk to you.
But I've only lost things from like Twitter specifically. I've lost things from Twitter. Like the last few times that like something went viral of mine on Twitter, I lost money. I lost projects. So like me sitting down and then not being on Twitter, I sat down and wrote a whole screenplay from not being on Twitter, not caring what's going on Twitter, not like, and so to me, it's the opposite where it's like, well, now I have this screenplay and like, that's a real thing that like I feel like if you think you don't have ideas, you do. You always say this thing about how you don't have ideas. And like, you are definitely a creative person. Like, you have tons of things to mine. You have tons of ideas.
But, like, I view online content as content. And so I need ideas for videos and I don't have them. Like, when I tell you that and then you say that's not true, like, you're just not listening to me. Like, the reality is that, like, every single day I try to think of an idea for a TikTok video and I can't. So, like, that is my reality.
But I see you as a very creative person with a lot of unique stuff to mine. But you always say stuff like I'm boring, and like, I just don't think that's true.
I don't think that I'm boring, but I think that I've already mined a lot of things. I've already written a lot of things in my life. I've already, you know, and like, I have a weekly blog for my Patreon. Like, it is hard for me to think of a topic every fucking week to talk about on my blog. Like, yeah. I have to post 5 days a week on Emotional Support Lady. It is hard for me to think of content to put on that, you know, mm-hmm. like, I do feel depleted. I do feel like I don't have much more to say or add to the conversation. And that's been a personal issue and battle that I've been dealing with.
I am sorry about that. I just see you as creative and interesting. And like, the idea that you're like, well, I've mined my whole life doesn't like compute for me, because you are so strange and interesting. And like, this has been a thing since like the beginning, where you're not aware of what about you is interesting, and then you think nothing about you is interesting, like you or that.
That's
you've
not what
mined.
I'm saying. I think you're taking what I'm saying and like blowing it out into like a level of like self hatred and like self judgment. I don't think that me as a person is like, I just am saying creatively, yeah. in terms of making content on a daily and weekly basis, yeah. I am struggling with that.
Yeah. I mean, I hear you.
And so, you know, like, I had started trying to get more into TikTok to be like, oh, I can do comedy videos on here, and maybe it won't be as like mental health focused. It'll just be more fun. Like, when I used to just like make sketches and stuff, and like, I don't have any ideas for it. And it's hard. And so, and you know, with like Twitter, it's like, I used to try to tweet once a day and it was like very disciplined. And now I'm trying to be like, maybe I wait more until a tweet comes to me. Mm-hmm. But then there's like a lot of times where nothing comes to me for a significant amount of time. And then I'm like, well, do I force myself to make something, or do I just wait? And so I am in a time of like, renegotiating my creative process with myself, because I think it used to be very disciplined and like, a large outpouring of content because I was on this strict schedule. And that's still true for everything Emotional Support Lady. But like, mm-hmm. for my other accounts, like, trying to just like let myself feel like, well, trusting that like, if I don't have an idea today, maybe I will have one next week. But like,
yeah.
putting that trust in myself is really fucking hard. And like, some days it goes a lot easier than other days. Especially because you see all these people making stuff and they're so creative and they're so good at it.
But this is what I'm worried about, is that how much of your like energy and depletion and like fear and whatever is based on watching what these other people are doing or seeing other people's tweets go viral. Like, once I stopped seeing what other people were doing and like muted kind of everybody on Instagram who I compare myself to, my actual work started being completed. Like, I think you being like, oh, these people are so creative, like, they are, but this is what this girl is talking about, is like, she has all of this art and stuff that she wants to do, but like, 90% of this email was like, I look at Instagram. I just think that is like, clearly you're upset right now, and like, I feel like it indicates that this stuff is like, toxic.
I don't think that my consumption of it is toxic. I just like, you know, I think we've always had very different relationships to social media. I enjoy watching TikTok as a consumer. Mm-hmm. It brings me joy. I think it's just this thing of like having to remind myself that like I'm just not having the same output that I used to have, and that I just like, and that's okay. And that like, when I do have a longer project, like I am able to complete it. The issue is never like completing work that I have. It's if I have the work, if I have the project, I can complete it. Yeah. It's more just even thinking of ideas for things I'm finding to be a bit tricky lately.
But I'm saying where I put the ideas, right? So like if I have an idea and I am like, ooh, that would be a really good tweet. Because I don't have Twitter, I go, what about that idea was good? Could it be a show? Could it be something where I like, you know, like I think I was giving stuff away for free on Twitter and then feeling pressured to keep building on that kind of thing. Or like, I don't know. And I just kept going in my mind over and over again, like I'm giving these apps things for free. And then it makes you feel like you're running out of ideas because you have to keep feeding this like free machine. When like, if you just stop and go like, in the beginning of my career, if I had an idea, I would be like, okay, that's a really good idea for an essay. How do I make that into an essay? But then it got to a period of like the time on Twitter where I would just be like, I would just have the idea and then tweet it out and like for free. And like, instead of taking the time and going, okay, well, this thought was interesting. Like what about that would resonate to humanity? The times where I've been viral have not been good. I had a two-book deal with a publishing company, and I had a tweet go viral that was like just misunderstood, that now people say the exact same thing and it's completely like nobody cares. But it just so happened that day, it was like the day that like the discourse decided to be viral about this one particular thing, which happens all the time. Like someone tweeted the other day, like, why don't cis men have bed frames? Which is a thing that I have seen tweeted 4,000 times by different women. And that day, it just so happened that someone saw it and picked it up and was like, this is whatever they said about it. So like, and then it became discourse. It's like the opposite of luck of the draw. So that day, I just so happened to be the person they chose to be the main character of Twitter. Because of that, the publisher reneged on the deal and I lost both of the books in the period of 24 hours because of a tweet. So it to me, it's not helping like to look at that stuff or to see everybody succeeding or to see like, I feel like I felt this deeply, like that it just became like a waste of time, a liability. And like, it makes you think that you're out of ideas when you're actually not out of ideas. You just are sucked into this thing that goes so fast.
I mean, I definitely agree with the liability part, and that has added to my anxiety a lot. And I think that is a large part of why, you know, because a lot of ideas I have, I go, oh, this could be misinterpreted incorrectly.
That's the problem. That's the thing. And you know what? Like when you tweet that can be misinterpreted and go whatever viral and blah, 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 and you are canceled. Okay, fine. But then if you write it into a book, if you write it into a screenplay, if you write it into an essay that contains nuance, then you get the benefit of being like, I said what I said in my art. Like, this is my art, and I said what I said in my art.
And I think that that's a great approach when it is your hobby and when it is your, you know, like you have other ways of getting money, but like you're acting as the like by writing that screenplay that ensures that I sell that screenplay, and that's not true.
No, but it creates no, of course not. But it creates,
like I haven't like been able to sell anything in a long time, and so like in over a year, and like that's scary. And so part of what I have to do to make myself more marketable to sell these bigger projects is I have to maintain this fan base online.
Yeah, I understand.
What I've done in the past is no longer building on itself. I've hit this thing where it's scary, and like I need to support myself. And so if I was like Reese Witherspoon, I wouldn't be on social media. Like if I hit a level where I knew that I was financially stable as a creative in this industry, I would delete my accounts, absolutely, in a lot of ways, but I'm not there yet. And so it is a part of my business, and that's what's tricky. Like my goal is to get to a place where I don't need to post, or when I post, it's literally just sugar being silly and it doesn't matter who looks at it because I have an overall deal with Amazon or what, you know, like, but I'm not in that place. And me just working on these bigger projects by myself, like there's no guarantee that those are going to sell.
You and I have very different creative processes, very different ways.
We also have different careers. You have to understand that.
Okay. we just have always had different opinions on like the creative process and the process of in what order things should. We just have very different opinions on art. I've lost things mostly from social media, maybe in a way that you've gained. I don't know. But I wonder how much art is not getting made because people are worried about Instagram or if it's viral worthy, or they're opposite, worried about if it does go viral in the wrong way, how much art is not being made because of that.
Right. And I mean, to back to the question, like, I think it's really helpful for people to be creative on the side, and to pick for it to be your main career is a lot. And it is scary, and it is not a meritocracy, and there's so much luck involved. And even if you are the best at what you do, that does not mean that you will be able to support yourself doing it. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's like a lot to be said for figuring out a way to have a job career that you like, and then continuing to do art and creativity on the side.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But I just worry about, like, 90% of this email was about Instagram and we didn't learn anything about her art.
Sure, but I guess for me, it's never been like it's either social media or my projects. Like, I've always been able to do both. I just feel like I struggle more with creating the content for the social media. Like, I could sit down and write a script tomorrow. It's more just like, you know, I don't see them, I guess, as mutually exclusive as you do. We have no idea if that was helpful for you at all, but, you know, it was helpful for us to process things out loud.
Yeah, please go tell Allison that she's a wonderful creative person who has tons of ideas. Okay.
If you want to submit your international question, you can send it to justbetweenuspod@gmail.com. That's justbetweenuspod@gmail.com.
Up next, we have tough questions with Olayami Aloran, so stick around. Like, this wasn't tough enough.
Hi, everyone. Allison here. Anyone who knows me well knows that I love to read. I am always looking for new books, and that is why I'm so excited that this episode is sponsored by Book of the Month. Book of the Month's mission is to help readers discover new books they love and to promote the work of emerging authors. It was so fun for me to get to pick which book I wanted to read this month and have it shipped right to my door. Book of the Month makes it easy to decide which book to read next. Each month, the editorial team reads through hundreds of new titles. They pick some of the best new books for you to choose from. All the books are good, so you can't go wrong. Every aspect of the Book of the Month experience is designed to be fun and special for readers. They have a highly anticipated release at the beginning of each month. Books are delivered in this really adorable bright blue box, and there's a fun app to help you pick your book and track your reading process. They also offer great values on new release hardcover fiction. It's much cheaper than other options. Shipping is always free, and with a loyalty program, you get rewards and even lower prices the longer you stay as a member. My first book from Book of the Month was The Husbands by Holly Gramazio. I am tearing through this book. It is so fun. It's basically about this woman who one day comes home and there's a husband in her apartment, and she's like, "Where did you come from?" And then she figures out that every time her new husband goes into the attic, a new husband comes out, and she's like shuffling through all these different husbands from the attic trying to figure out which one is the best. It is right up my alley, and I love it so much. So if you want to take part in Book of the Month and have a brand new book shipped right to your door every single month, go to bookofthemonth.com and get your first book for $5 with code PETALS. That's $5 off with code PETALS. I cannot recommend this enough.
Has dealing with stress and trying to get more focused a New Year's resolution you haven't cracked yet or don't really know how to fix? I have a lot of trouble staying focused, and I also get super stressed out, and I think that not being able to stay focused really dovetails with that. So if there was a way for me to keep my focus that didn't also cause my brain to get so scattered with stress, I would love to be able to fix it. I sometimes can't focus on the task at hand because I'm so busy realizing that there are things I need to do on the Just Between Us Instagram account. So I'll be like fully writing something, and all of a sudden my brain will go, JBU Instagram, have to post on social media. Truvaga is a handheld product that stimulates the vagus nerve to improve overall health and wellness. Stimulating the vagus nerve with Truvaga helps to balance and strengthen the nervous system, which reduces stress, increases focus, improves mood, and improves sleep. Truvaga is owned by ElectroCore and uses its patented technology for overall health and wellness benefits. Its utilized technology is the most clinically studied and tested vagus nerve therapy available. Customizable sessions are only 2 minutes long. Recommended usage is one session in the morning and one at night. Truvaga comes programmed with 350 sessions, which, if used twice a day, will last approximately 6 months. It's drug-free and easy-to-use therapy to help improve your health. No app or phone is required. We offer free standard shipping, payment plan options, and a 30-day money-back guarantee. It's only available in the U.S. at this time. Visit Truvaga.com, T-R-U-V-A-G-A.com, and enter promo code JUSTBETWEENUS to enhance your wellness journey, support this podcast, and receive $15 off. That's Truvaga.com. Check out promo code JUSTBETWEENUS.
With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you all about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions you wish to ask. And then she can either type her response or use their voice-to-text feature. And MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Right before I found out about this project, my mom made an offhand comment about wanting to write a memoir because she had such a wild childhood and there are all these things she's never really talked to us about. But asking someone to sit down and write a memoir is kind of daunting. So then I got her MyLifeInABook.com, and now she's getting prompts to answer on a weekly basis, and it's a lot easier than just undertaking an entire memoir. I'm so excited to see what my mom does with MyLifeInABook.com because she's someone who doesn't always feel comfortable just sharing about herself, but having these prompts and knowing that I really want to hear her answers is going to inspire her to probably share more with me about her life and her upbringing than I've ever been shared with before. So I'm so excited for that. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use code JUSTBETWEENUS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com. Use code JUSTBETWEENUS for 10% off today.
Welcome back to Just Between Us. It's time for the juiciest, most scandalous, controversial segment known to all of podcasting, Tough Questions.
This week on the show, we have Oleyemi Olorun, who is a public defender and Allison's favorite Twitter follow and a legal commentator and a legal observer and a writer and just all around cool person. Hello.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me.
I want to get into the public defending of it all and the court system. And I was listening to an interview you did, and just starting off of, like, you were saying, you know, people think that the justice system isn't working, but it is actually working the way it was intended.
Yeah.
Can you sort of elaborate a bit on that?
I think it's two things. I think people tend to think of the criminal system as having mistakes, and those mistakes are things that are these insidious things that happen in the dark, like something you got to parse out. But in actuality, if you step into a court, all of the racism and discrimination and all of the injustice that you see people writing about that come off like these horrendous anomaly stories, it's just a daily practice of being in court. It's not something you have to look for. It's very clear. Like, you could see it in the way the court officers talk to your Black clients, the way the court officers talk to you as a Black lawyer, they mistake for a client, you know. It's very, very clear. So that's what I mean. People tend to think of the criminal system. They call it, in and of itself, they call it the criminal justice system. Like, the implication there is that it's this wheel of justice. That's what it's there to do and to right wrongs. So when you hear about it doing unjust things, you think it's a mistake. That's literally why it's named that. It's a very deliberate misnomer. It's so that people automatically buy into it. So in and of itself, it's just plain as day once you see it in action.
What is it like to be a public defender? Because I know that you guys get so many cases. You're so overworked. Like, is that part of how it's rigged against people and that they're not getting the same representation that they should?
Absolutely. I think obviously it's meant to put your clients and that entire part of the system at a disadvantage. There's really no other way to put it. There's no other reason why we make less than prosecutors. We're funded less. We are in these different positions. So for sure, without fail. I'm fortunate. I work at the Legal Aid Society, and that's one of the more probably best funded, you know what I mean, of public defense organizations. So, but yes, it definitely creates strain. But I think in any legal work and in anything that you're doing, depending on what your life and your circumstances are, can make things work. For me, I'm a single 20 something year old person. I don't got no children. So I can do this. I have the time. I can do it.
I feel like I hear all the time, though, that a lot of times people who've been convicted are just told to take plea deals, whether or not they even did the crime.
So, okay, we're going to have this conversation. All right, let's I think a lot of blame, a lot of what is wrong with the criminal system is intentionally placed on the backs of defense attorneys and public defenders who have nothing to do with it. The reason why pleas, you know what I mean, you're in a position why you have to take a plea, or why a plea is something that a public defender or the lawyer is conveying to you, we didn't make the plea. The plea is the prosecution, and it's the prosecutors and the judges and the legislators that have set it up where you're in the worst position possible. You know, it's like if the plea offer, if I could get you an offer of 3 years, but otherwise you go to jail and you're risking 15 to 25. You know what I mean? And I recognize that as unfair as it is, I can think all I want in my soul that this is wrong. Like, this is wrong. This should not be happening, right? You shouldn't be being charged for this. This kind of behavior shouldn't be criminalized. We shouldn't respond to this with, you know, incarceration, but we do. That is exactly how the system responds. I could feel that way all I want. If I know that this judge is going to convict you, I know what they think they have, you know, this and the next thing. It's my job and also my literal obligation to convey what the plea offer is. So I think, and I get it. And like, and this is the thing. Clients, they deal with you. They're interacting with you. They don't have the opportunity to take out their frustrations on the prosecution or the judge. And also they don't have that understanding of the system. They don't really, you know what I mean? It's not, they don't have the burden. It shouldn't be on their burden to have to figure out who do I, you know, address my qualms with. And I also think there is some legitimacy, of course, to any like criticisms about public defenders, right? Like, not every public defender is a saint, you know, and it goes both ways. But I get it. I get it in the sense that they have to, who else? We're the ones coming to them with the offer. And a lot of times people tend to think, especially because of how the criminal system is portrayed in the media and on TV and stuff, people think that you're not trying hard enough, or there is this magical way. You know, you watch TV and you know, fake lawyers get up in court and just start a speech, and it doesn't work like, but your clients do feel like you can do that. Like, say this word, say this plea for me. And it's like, I'm telling you, you're up between a rock and a hard place. So yeah, I mean, there's that. I will never say, like, most cases don't go to trial. That's just the reality about the criminal system. 9 out of 10 things are going to plea out in some way, whether or not it's a plea to a criminal conviction, you know, or a violation or disorderly, something lesser. But most things do, in fact, end in pleas. That's the truth. But that's just the reality of how the legislators and the prosecutors and the judges have set it up.
I saw a video of you talking about the types of crimes that get brought to court for largely Black and brown people that are not, you know, like a family member calling on another family member, and what kinds of like mistakes are made there, or how much harder it is there?
It's honestly, most of the cases that I see are just like regular like disputes. Like, someone got mad at their roommate. It'll be something like two roommates got into an argument. Someone was, you know, cursing each other out. So someone calls the police, and now they automatically arrest the roommate. Now there's an order of protection. That roommate can't live there, you know, or a mother is upset with her son because the son's not doing homework or he's skipping school or something like that. So she decides, I'm going to call the police, you know, have the police come talk to him or scam the police instead, arrest her child, issue an order of protection that she does not want. Now her child is homeless, you know, or someone very common. People call the police because someone's having a mental health episode, or, you know, and they don't know how to respond to it. They want to get them to the hospital. They want arrest them. Even when they take them to the hospital, tell them, you know, oh, I'm just taking you to the hospital. The minute they get released from the hospital, they're at the doors to shackle them, you know? So it's just everyday silliness. Like, more times than not, I open a case and I'm like, you can't be serious. Like, what, like, are we having a serious conversation? Sometimes I even have to make it a point to make noise to the judge. Like, judge, let's be serious. Open this, read it, read the actual allegations and tell me we don't have better things we can do with our time. So yeah, like, those are the cases.
Is the judge ever responsive to that?
Yeah, like, sometimes the judges, you know, judges indicate to you how they feel. You get the impression that they think a case is stupid. When a judge's case is really stupid, they'll say, you know, the minute it starts, they go, people, can we resolve this? Can we resolve this like now? They, you know, they make it kind of known that they think you should, you know, make an offer. The prosecution should get rid of it. You know, I had a case once where my client was, it wasn't even a crime. Like, it wasn't even charged as a crime, like violation littering. He threw a Capri, they accused him of throwing a Capri Sun on the ground and they beat the brakes off it. Yes. Beat him, tased him, beat him so badly, like he was there in a hospital gown, like could not walk. And I'm like, to the judge, like the judge turned like with outrage with me, like to the people, like, are you serious? Are you not? And they still wouldn't, like, it's not even a criminal charge, but they still would not get rid of the case. They still were like, oh, we're not prepared to do anything. We don't care. Like, oh, we'll make a note for the sign. Like, when I make my big record, like, my client is literally, he's been tased, he's been beaten. Look at him, you know what I mean? The judge is saying this, they're like, We'll make a note for the assigned prosecutor. That's it. Oftentimes in court, it feels like I'm the only sane person in the room. I'm like, mm-hmm. I wish it was an audience. Like, are people seeing what I, it's just not, it's illogical.
And what is fueling all of this? Is it just racism and classism? Like,
I think racism, classism combined with power, maintenance of power, and mm-hmm. Just the reality that this is a business, right? Like, I think When you're talking about things as a structure and you know, as a system that's corrupt, you forget, you know, these are individual people with just like personal motivations, right? Like lawyer types, like, I'm trying to get a job. I'm trying to move up mobility. Like, not me, them. Like, I'm trying to move up mobility. You know what I mean? Like, they're looking, they like just the fact, whatever Joe Schmo, like, oh, I'm a prosecutor. I'm assigned this now. Oh, I'm a judge. Oh, I'm this. I'm trying to, you know what I mean? So everybody's trying to rub shoulders with everybody. Everybody's trying to get in where they fit in. So it's just this larger system, this boys club that's at work. So yeah, it's all of these different things that are already present in how the system runs, but a lot of it is just personal gain and people not being prepared to make integrity like decisions. Because there are some people that, you know, work in these positions that work at the DA's or, you know, even court officers or something, that actually would, if you ask them what they really felt or something, you know, they would be inclined to recognize like, this is not right or this is unjust. Or I have a friend from law school who's a prosecutor and he called me blue in the face every day about something, you know, bad that he thinks they're doing. And it's like, yeah, okay, we'll quit. You know what I mean? Say right. Something, you know what I mean? But they're not going to do that. And I'm not, you know, shooting anybody, you know, whatever, self-preservation is key, I suppose. But they're not going to say anything. And, you know, I guess you have to make a decision whether or not you think there's any difference in that or what's worse. Like the people who are consciously on the side of the wrong that they're doing are the people that are like, I don't think it's so great, but it's my job. And they're still doing the same thing and working towards the same ends.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there is any way that we can restructure how flawed this system is? Like, is there hope here at all?
Restructure it? No. It's not. This is not a structure. It's not a structuring problem. It's every aspect of it. Like, here's my thing. You know, before I decided I wanted to become a public defender, like how that moment came, I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. I was an undergrad and I was writing my thesis on raising the criminal system and whatnot. And, you know, I determined that it felt essential. It's necessary that I do this work. But that means from this perspective, I've been looking at this and all the different levels of this process and who's in the system and how it works since then. And what I've realized since going to law school and since going to court and, you know, meeting all these people, you know, I've interned at the DA's office. I'm a public defender. I did all of this. It's not an accident. You know what I mean? Like in all of the ways that you think like, oh, you know, people will talk about how coercion happens. You know what I mean? Like all these like factors that are compounded, but in actuality, right, it doesn't just like happen to fall onto people. Like there are prosecutors, people, judges, legislators making calculated decisions to make things, you know what I mean? To put people in the position where they have to take a plea or where they're stuck in jail or where they're doing all these different things. It isn't like, you know, if we tweaked right here, we could get the system quite right. No, it's people actively very involved. It's a very organized, structured, messed up system. And these people, you know, are enforcing it. So no, you can't. If you restructure it, you just shuffle it around. So no, I think honestly, the system, I think there's always going to be progress that's made, right? In the form of reform or concessions. Like, I definitely think you can move further this way. But I think if you're looking, if you want to be honest about what is actually going to like completely change the system, it's literally a new system. You have to get rid of the problem. That's what it is. But as far as a medium goes, I think it will progress. Maybe these little initiatives, you know, might make it a little better and you'll keep working and you'll keep adding more on it. But just in and of itself, it needs way more than just a few tune-ups, just a few different laws. The whole thing how criminality is constructed in this country. You know, our understanding of who is a criminal, what is a crime, where police need to be, how essential police are. It goes so much deeper than just looking at the court, right?
Yeah, can we talk a little bit about that, about our view of what crime is?
I actually was talking about this. I was just watching Sexy Beast before we came on this, right? My friend was over and we were watching Sexy Beast. And two white people are on the date and they're like, you know, doing a little cute little date banter. And the guy asked her, oh, what's the wildest place you've ever had sex or something? She's like, well, I've had sex in public a lot. And he's like, oh, me too. And I'm like, isn't this cute how like when you watch white things, it's like, oh, quirky. White, like the way like things that would automatically have a criminal connotation in anybody else's movie story media presentation. Mm-hmm. When you watch white things, it's just like quirky. It doesn't have the same. I'm like, see, that's a cute little quirky date story for y'all, but that's sex offender registry for Black and people of color, right? And when I watch How I Met Your Mother, the first episode, when Ted Mosby decides he's going to steal the blue horn for Robin, I'm like, in Manhattan. So I know for a fact what charges, I'm like, if you were a Black person, charges of full order protection, you can never go back to that restaurant. As a matter of fact, you can't even be on the streets of that restaurant. Yeah, like, so it's things like that. I think about that very, very often. I was watching Back to the Future on the plane and I'm like, reckless driving, la, la, la. Like, I'm just looking at all the charges. And the thing about it is, it seems like, you know, you're being like, oh, jokes. But if you watch Black media, you watch people of color shows, movies, anything, whatever, the police are very much so, there's even in our fictional things, even in the like most lighthearted thing, they're a part of it because you could never do these same kind of playful activities. Even our media, they're so entrenched in criminalizing us in real life. We can't even portray it in a fictional universe in a media without it being responded to with police. But white shows is just like, even in the episode of Sex and the City where Carrie decides she's going to smoke weed because Burger dumped her on a post-it note. So she's like, oh, she can have a fun night. And the police like put her in the car, like arrest her, whatever. And the next thing you know, they're at the diner drinking Frosties, laughing about, oh, that was the night I got arrested. And I'm just like, uh-huh. That'd be a Yale of court. And that's what I'm thinking. Anybody else. And that's what, to me, it's like that. Like how Black people and people of color and crime is literally discussed and how it's painted as crime as opposed to just regular living, fun stories and experiences or whatever in the media is very, very central to how it's viewed. It's the way that like when people talk about violence and violent crimes and they talk about Black neighborhoods and Black people fighting and da da da, every white guy I know has been in a bar fight, a brawl, something, you know, they're getting all kinds of scraps in it, but it's like, it's just a part of boyishness, manhood, da da da. You know, and it has an entirely different spin that it's given when we're dealing with non-Black and people of color. So that in and of itself portrays so much that once you get in the court, how people view Black people, oh, you're accused of this crime, oh, it was assault. No one cares about the details, anything. It's how these things are labeled, right? It's a playful fight when some white kids are fighting and it's an assault, and you know what I mean? And a threat and an intimidation and menacing and all this different stuff when it's other people. So that's what I mean. Like that, how we view different people, different groups, and what we think of as crime in and of itself informs how our criminal system shakes down, how juries think, how juries convict. So.
And so much of it is at the police's discretion, right? In terms of what they arrest and what they enforce. And
yes.
Like I think you've said elsewhere, like, you know, that they just put more police in Black and brown communities.
Exactly. They just line those communities. And this is the thing. If you put a magnifying glass to absolutely anybody, they're doing something illegal, right? America is a place that is overly, everything has been regulated. There is a law for everything that you could think of. There is a criminal regulation. It is the most overly policed and on paper place that I could think of. Like, I was raised in the Bahamas. It's not like this. I got to America and I'm like, whoa, what is happening? You do not need to, you know, but it is like that. And so the reality is, there's a law. Everybody could be held criminally responsible for something, but they only choose certain people and communities to deal with it in that way and to respond to it in that way. And so that's what you end up getting left with, is just unfair application. And I don't want, and I want to always be clear about this, I don't want the system to level up in the sense that I don't want white people to be as mistreated by the criminal law as everybody else. You know what I mean? That's not what I'm looking for. I'm not looking for a punitive criminal system that's, you know, handing all of us ourselves. But I want the same recognition that you have that things don't need to be criminal, or you don't need to respond to that, or that's not helpful, or the same concern you have for those families in that community, you know, have that for ours, you know? Like my friend told me, based back to the Sexy Beast discussion, he's like, he went out with a white girl once and she told him how, you know, she got pulled over for a DUI and the police just escorted her home. And he's like, must be nice. And yeah. I'm like, and the thing is, and hear me out. That is what should happen. Logically speaking, like, if you think you somebody is drunk driving, somebody's driving when they shouldn't be, that's a danger to them or to other people. If your job as a police officer is to protect and serve the community, that's what you should do. You should make sure this person gets home safely. And you should do that for everybody. You shouldn't. Right. Why does this person get escorted home and the rest of them is going to get violently beat and arrested and possibly killed and be stuck in court for who knows how long, probably with a criminal conviction that's going to affect the rest of your life and all kind of fines you can't pay. That's what's unfair. So it's not that they're, you know, that they have this leniency towards white people. It's that you recognize all of these same fundamental, the same way you thought this was better to help her than to punish her. Why is it not better to help us than to punish us?
Right. And what role do you think that private prisons play in all of this?
I think private prisons are obviously bad. Like, the obvious, everybody knows that. But public prisons are not no peach on a beach either. And there's privatization happening in, like, even in, within public prisons, right? They're still being used. Inmates are still being used for prison labor. You know what I mean? It's still being done there. It's still being done for a profit. All these things are still happening there. So while private prisons are heinous, they are not especially heinous by comparison to public prisons the way that it's been made. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, when you're able to focus on one, people like to feel like, oh, if I fix this one thing, I can still otherwise keep the system intact. Like, mm-hmm. It's not like prison isn't the problem itself. You know what I mean? And the fact that we have this criminal system and this mass incarceration, it's just this accident, this private prisons thing that somehow was born out of it. That was a mistake. That's causing bad stuff. And then people can focus their energies there while still being fully invested in maintaining the system that's otherwise perpetuating the harm. So private prisons are bad, but public prisons are bad too, because all of the prisons are bad.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? Like, are you pro abolishing prisons? Like, what do you think is the right solution?
I'm an abolitionist, but I want to make sure I say this. This is a lot of, like, you know, catchiness of, like, being like abolish now and all of this. I don't use that for a very specific reason, because I think it takes away from what the argument is, right? Like, I recognize that abolition can't happen overnight. The whole concept is the idea that you start divesting from this mass incarceration, this criminal system that we've invested so heavily in, and start putting those funds elsewhere into the community, into mental health resources, into solving and addressing the root causes of crime and helping those communities. And by doing that, you naturally don't end up with so much crime or so many problems, right? Because it's not untrue that people are doing things that they shouldn't be doing, right? Or that wrong things happen, or that you know, mental illness and all these different things lead to horrible things. So we want to actually address that and, you know, decrease the prevalence of seeing things like that in society, right? So the concept of, like, if I say abolish now, obviously that would never happen, but even theoretically, how people who don't understand what abolition is respond to it, you know, is going to be with rightful alarm, I guess, to some degree, because that doesn't consciously make sense. What I'm trying to do is, you know, over they start unplugging from it so that eventually we live in a society that doesn't have to have this. You know what I mean? We don't have to have a system that relies on prison. So yeah, ultimately I'm for abolition. I don't think that incarceration doesn't do anything for anybody. It's just punitive. That's all it is. Like, it doesn't accomplish anything in the sense that it doesn't erase the harm that's happened. It does not prevent future harm. In fact, it pretty much guarantees that you're gonna have future harm. No one goes into the criminal system. Goes into prison, you know, they're exposed to all kind of violence and worse circumstances. And people know that. It's not like they don't know that. You know, prison is not a good place. You know, people are in constant danger. So I don't know what you think that would breed if the conditions that they've lived in already in their community, in their society, has led them to this point. By worsening all of their life conditions, I don't know how you think they're going to respond to stress, confrontation, conflict, and problems, right? It's only going to be worse. So to me, if I'm really trying to better the society around me and better the community, I have to want to better the people that you think are so bad, or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. The people that are in the criminal system. If they are the quote unquote problem, that is what is harming the rest of us. Well, you need to help those people to help yourself, you know? So I think maybe people need to change the way they see it, because they tend to look at it as just like forgiving, not getting to have what they believe is like rightful anger and hatred and disdain and wanting to punish people. And it's not really about that. You need to look at it as, you know, self-preservation for you and the community around you. So yeah, that's where I'm at with it.
And so what would be the right step if, like, someone does commit a crime, and, like, how does reform happen?
If someone commits a crime, I think Well, here's the thing. A lot of, when you say crime, like what kind of crime? Because most crime is not what we think of as like, most crime is not violent crime at all. It's not right. rapes and murders and all these things. It's not that at all. Most crime is like, you curse somebody out, you threaten like, oh, I'm gonna beat your ass. You know what I mean? Like, it's just regular like activity. So, you know, people will ask me, how do I feel if my clients are guilty? And I'm like, I often, if you mean guilty, like whether or not they did the thing someone said that they did, yeah, a lot of time that's the case. And I don't think that that thing should be being criminally prosecuted. It doesn't need to be there. Sometimes I think people forget, and in other countries, like life just moves on, you know, like in real life, like, no, it just does. Like in the Bahamas or something, if somebody, if you know, my friend gets beat up, then he got beat up. That's a thing that happened. You know what I mean? Like life moves on. That is a story we know. You got cursed out. That wasn't fair. That wasn't right. You know, life, not everything requires like, let me bring down the hammer. I have been wronged. I must get retribution. It's just not that. So I'm like, yeah. If somebody did something, then they did something wrong. Address them in real life. Go talk to them. Like there are other ways. And I think that in and of itself makes us forget like what community is supposed to be. But community is supposed to be people that like take you to task, you know, within that so that you don't have to rely on a criminal system and all that. Address people. You know, when people in your life do terrible things or they do things you don't approve of or whatever, address them. Tell them that. Open your mouth. Stop looking for a criminal system to want to take everything from them and radically change the rest of their life. For what? That's what I think about. It's like, it'll be, we're in court for a year fighting about somebody slapped somebody a year ago. This person has moved, days are gone. You've continued living your life. Everybody's living. Why are we in court? Possibly, you know, change, like, why are we in court? It just doesn't make sense. So yeah, I think, you know, if they commit a crime, like they have committed a crime, like depending on what it is, some things like, listen, I understand, like everybody's free to, there are some things that are outrageous. You know, there's the rare anomaly serial killer, these things, but these are not indicative of what you're seeing in the criminal system. That's just not what it is. I got 100 cases underneath this laptop and they're all goofy. Just regular human interaction. So I just think you can let things rock. I think things like this, just, you just move on. People have committed crime against me before, just moved on. Like life just kept going. Like we addressed that in other ways. I know I don't like this person. I told them how I feel about that. Like, you know, other ways. It doesn't got to be court. Not everything has to be court, America. Like,
and so much is probably drug charges too, right? So like, what would it look like to decriminalize drugs? How would that completely change the court system?
And the thing is, they like to jail people so much. They're so in the business of jailing people that even when something is like decriminalized and they know like we ultimately, they're not going to be able to continue on with the prosecution of it, they still arrest them. They still arrest them. They still bring the charges. Right? I got like, people have been saying, even though weed was just officially, you know, this year, people have been saying weed is decriminalized and pain in New York as this progressive utopia since when? Since I got it, I've been like, my first case was a marijuana case. So like, they arrest people for it. It's who they arrest for it. It's how they respond to it. That's different. You know, yeah. They're not arresting the white guys in Williamsburg and Manhattan. That's true. They can smoke their weed on the street. Not everybody else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they need to decriminalize drugs, but they also, rather than just decriminalize drugs, some things just need to be legal because decriminalization just gives them option. Discretion. You get to make a choice. Police and prosecutors just get to execute, like exercise their own personal judgment. And where do you think those personal judgments lead them? Right. So that's always I'm always cautious that I'm aware of that. Like even my friend is staying with me, and when he came in, he's like, "Oh, we can smoke weed in New York." I was like, I was like, "Don't go to this." I was like, "Do not go in the street smoke." He's like, "Oh, I saw this guy in Manhattan in Times Square smoking weed." I was like, "You saw him smoking weed? You don't." Do not do it because I'm going to be mad if I have to come out my bed to come get you out of jail. Like, so it's different. Yeah.
And can we talk a little bit about the actual root of quote unquote crime and how that is like so misunderstood and seen as like a moral failing versus like a result of the society we live in?
Yeah. The root of crime is poverty. And the problem is people think poverty is like some kind of self-imposed choice. You know, like people are just up and choosing to live stressful, worse lives. I think everybody has a like an innate understanding of this and they just kid themselves. Everybody knows poverty and stressful conditions is what leads to crime because the minute the economy's bad, the minute there was a lockdown, you know what I mean? Everyone was concerned for their safety. As soon as it feels like money is tight, you know what I mean? People immediately respond. The minute the lockdown happened, gun sales were, all the guns were bought from the stores. You know why? Because people started preparing for a purge and all kind of battle to happen because in their mind, they're like, people are going to be broke. People are going to be stressed. People are going to be home. And when people are broke and when people are stressed and when people can't pay their bills and when people have all kind of conditions decrease in the quality of their living, that is when things get frosty. You know what I mean? Like, you're a lot more likely to knock somebody out if you can't pay your rent. You know, if you're having a bad day, if things are already going bad, there's all these other things happening to you, you're going to respond to things not as your best self because you're not your best self, you know? So that's what it is. And a lot, and what these neighborhoods that they call, you know, impoverished neighborhoods and impoverished communities and marginalized, they didn't get that way accidentally. It's where funding is being put. It's where, and it's happened. I don't think I have the time to walk anybody through the whole history from slavery to now and all of the different other social and legal injustices that have happened in this country. But poverty is not by happenstance. It's not an accident. There's a reason why certain communities have, and it's because they took and they maintained at the expense of others. So that, like, living in impoverished conditions leads to crime. And I think that to me is evident just in the way American, like, media and celebritydom is done, right? Oftentimes, a American celebrity that they love so much is because they have an underdog story is how they paint it. You know, like, they reference, oh, where they grew up and they were poor and all these other unsavory things that, you know, used to happen in their life when they were poor and growing up and coming up. And now it's like this big story. And it's like, but the country that you live in is jails these people, jails them. Like, that says that they are on a regular basis unredeemable. They need to go to jail. They need to be locked away. But those exact same people, when they happen to avoid that and make it, you know, and now they're rich and it is just this love cherished person you all have around. You have them on your walls. You're inviting them to hang out with Robert Kraft. You're doing all this different stuff. Like, they don't have a criminal record because you're not scared, because you recognize what was scary about them or what things you thought were so scary, what wrong things they were doing was circumstance based. The moment that you realize that that is no longer their circumstances, you don't fear them. You're not worried about them. You know, they don't need to be locked away. So to me, Americans, I think if you do just one more analysis to it and you look at how you really, like, perceive celebrities and people and just look around, it's very clear. And I feel like the answer is there. You know that it's poverty and circumstance. It's not that people are irredeemable monsters. I've represented, what, 1,000 people accused of crimes. I don't know any freak show monsters, no person that didn't make sense. I've never heard, you know, I've never read a complaint and not heard the other side or a story or something that's like, yeah, it seems about like life. I've heard a story like this. You know, these aren't these aberration, magical, mythical, terrible people. They're just regular people. They're just regular people with some, like, circumstances who are poor, who are struggling, who are facing and battling other things. And that's just what it is.
How do you get up every day and work in a system that is so rigged?
Because I believe it's necessary. The only reason I do what I do is because it's important. You know, I've always wanted to be a lawyer. That was always the case. But the older I get, the more I realize that I don't dream of a life of labor. I'm like, wow, wouldn't it be nice if I could lay in my bed and not do any of this stressful stuff, right? So to me, the only thing that is going to be so much more important than my, like, peace, chilling and all of this is, honestly, to fight for Black people. That's really what it is. Black people and marginalized people and fighting against a criminal system that I know is wrong, because I know that that's happening. Like, that's something I'm consciously thinking about every day. The fact that I'm, you know, a Black person who can walk around and talk and free, and I know there's so many people that look like me that are really, like, stuck in a prison cell and is, you know, seemingly nothing that could be done about it. And it's more that they're trying to put there. That's a problem for me. I think sometimes I was having this conversation with some of my friends. You know, we forget, like, it's easy to think, you know, racism and all these, like, terrible systems of injustice are far away or something because it's not happening to you. And you live in a time mm-hmm. where things seem so modern. You're on the computer, you're talking to all these people. If you look out, it seems like we're all mingling together. You know, Beyonce is Beyonce. You know, there's so many, like, populist, successful people, Black people. You can forget that, oh, no. This is the exact same America where this is still happening, where the average Black man between 18 to 29 years old is still likely to be incarcerated at some point in his life, where, you know, all of my Black male friends can relate to having been arrested at some point in time or been profiled by a police officer. Me, myself, have been pulled over in a car 14 times in New York City. Like, you know, and I know that, and I can't unknow that. So for me, it's a matter of, it's not good enough for me. I wouldn't be able to, like, live with myself, because it's the same reason why I decided I needed to be a public defender as opposed to doing something like divorce law, which I had thought I wanted to do at the beginning of colleges. I don't think it's sufficient in a system where Black people are disproportionately profiled, arrested, and incarcerated for me as a Black person to just become a lawyer and go do something that doesn't actively benefit Black people. You know what I mean? We're less than 5% of the legal profession, despite being so overrepresented in the criminal system. that's an issue. And I don't think the only Black person in the courtroom should be the defendant. I think people deserve to be and are at an advantage by having an attorney that looks like them, that sees them, is going to humanize them and understand them and really care about what the impact is going to be on their family and on the community and try to take that psychological component into consideration. So that's why.
Well, that was a wonderful answer.
Thank you.
This has been so helpful and illuminating. And now I just have to ask if you want to play a silly game show.
Yes, I'll play it.
So this game show is called Hypotheticals. I'm going to give you a series of hypothetical situations. You can ask any clarifying questions that you have, and then you would tell me what you would do in that situation.
Okay, I'm excited. Okay.
So our first game is America's favorite game show. Would you stay with this cheater?
I'm excited.
You've been married for 30 years. You find out that 10 years ago, your partner drunkenly made out with your neighbor at a block party. This neighbor has been trying unsuccessfully to steal them away from you ever since with elaborate schemes and love letters. Would you stay with this cheater?
Yeah, I'm going to stay with my, first of all, a kiss. We've been together 30 years ago, and this happened a decade ago, and I've been chilling happily and loving my house. I'm not leaving my husband over no kiss, but I'm going to beat that woman's ass. That's going to happen. What? Not because she kissed my husband, you know. You know, I like that. That's not, you know, whatever. You didn't make the obligation. No, that's different. But you actively try to steal my husband every... Oh, no. What? And you've been actively scheming to get him since a decade. That's a decade of trying to stress me out to get my husband. I'm whooping your ass daily. Like, yeah, that's what's happening.
Are you upset that your husband didn't tell you about the scheme for 10 years? Like you just found out about it.
I just found out and because he told me.
Yeah, like you find a love letter and then you discover that she's been asking.
He's writing letters to my husband?
Mm-hmm. He's been keeping it from you.
And he was responding. He didn't tell us.
He wasn't responding. He, other than the kiss, he wasn't interested. But he's been keeping it from you for 10 years that she's been after him.
Did he tell this woman that his wife is crazy? Like, what? We can have a problem. First of all, on one hand, I want to think, I'm trying to think of what my ex-boyfriends would think about me. And I could see a man that's with me thinking, you know what? She can carry on bad. I'm just not going to respond to the woman. So there's no need for me to tell her because it's going to be a thing. I could see that. And mm-hmm. I could think that's reasonable and plausible. But not you getting no letters from no woman and you keeping them. We're going to have a problem. But I'm not going to divorce him. But we're going to exchange words.
That's a very good answer. I'll accept it.
Good.
Okay. So our next game is this a date? You mentioned you need to go to the DMV to get a real ID, and your coworker says that they need to do that too. They suggest making appointments on the same day so that you can keep each other company. But on the day of the appointment, your coworker shows up at the DMV with a picnic basket. Is this a date?
First of all, hell no. No, and a picnic basket at the DMV? Sir.
Do you think they think it's a date?
I think they need to go talk to somebody professionally if they think so. I think they might if they brought a picnic or, you know, first of all, where are you going to, let me just say this, I want to know, where are you going to spread the picnic basket at the DMV? Like on the seats on the side? That's gross. I think he thinks it's a date. I think he thinks it's a date and I think he's goofy.
Yeah. So you're, yes. So it's a date, but no, thank you.
No, it's not a date. He thinks it's a date.
He got it.
It is not a date. I wanted to go get my license and this man wanted to do it at the same time. Okay. And he brought food with his presumptuous self and I'm going to eat because you brought the food, but we are not on a date. All right. You are mad I work with who came to the DMV same time as me.
I like that you're still going to eat the food. I support that.
Absolutely. And I've been waiting at the DMV all day. Of course I'm going to eat.
Okay. Our last game is, are you a terrible parent? Your 14-year-old won't stop texting. In order to make them averse to texting all the time, whenever they do it, you murmur just loud enough for them to hear, click, clack, clickety clack.
Oh, that's
click,
oppression. Clack, no,
until
that's
it's so annoying they throw their phone at you. Are you a terrible parent?
Yes, I'm oppressive. Yes, yes, yes. My best friend, Dave, every time I'm eating, he does this. Every single time. And I hate it with all my heart. That is the worst. Why are you oppressing the baby? Why do you can't tax? What's the problem? Like, let them get food. No. First of all, yeah, definitely terrible. Now your child got all kind of trauma. Now this child is going to be 27 trying to figure out why they respond to text in the way that they do. They get anxious, like, oh, I don't like the text. They're going to be getting cursed out by some significant other about why they never respond to their text. And be like, I've been through some things. Like, so, yes, bad parent.
I have to say, I appreciate your decisiveness throughout this game of hypotheticals.
Thank you.
Other guests have sort of, you know, not known, asked more questions. You, like, knew immediately, and I really respect it.
Thank you
so much for joining us. Where can people follow you and find out more about everything that you're up to and writing about?
Everywhere on social media is Miss O'Lurin, MSOLURIN. Follow me.
And there's lots of good cat content as well.
He is literally next to me being a talker.
Thank you so much.
Has dealing with stress and trying to get more focused a New Year's resolution you haven't cracked yet or don't really know how to fix? I have a lot of trouble staying focused, and I also get super stressed out, and I think that not being able to stay focused really dovetails with that. So if there was a way for me to keep my focus that didn't also cause my brain to get so scattered with stress, I would love to be able to fix it. I sometimes can't focus on the task at hand because I'm so busy realizing that there are things I need to do on the Just Between Us Instagram account. So I'll be like fully writing something and all of a sudden my brain will go, JBU Instagram, have to post on social media. Truvaga is a handheld product that stimulates the vagus nerve to improve overall health and wellness. Stimulating the vagus nerve with Truvaga helps to balance and strengthen the nervous system, which reduces stress, increases focus, improves mood, and improves sleep. Truvaga is owned by ElectroCore and uses its patented technology for overall health and wellness benefits. Its utilized technology is the most clinically studied and tested vagus nerve therapy available. Customizable sessions are only 2 minutes long. Recommended usage is one session in the morning and one at night. Truvaga comes programmed with 350 sessions, which, if used twice a day, will last approximately 6 months. It's drug-free and easy-to-use therapy to help improve your health. No app or phone is required. We offer free standard shipping, payment plan options, and a 30-day money-back guarantee. It's only available in the U.S. at this time. Visit Truvaga.com, TRUVAGA.com, and enter promo code JUSTBETWEENUS to enhance your wellness journey, support this podcast, and receive $15 off. That's TRUVAGA.com. Check out promo code JUSTBETWEENUS.
Back to Just Between Us. It's time for topics.
XXXXXXX, baby.
Baby.
Okay, so Bennifer's just a way in, but we did want to say, why do we care about celebrity relationships? First of all, I fell down a rabbit hole.
Of who?
Conspiracy. Ooh. Regarding Jennifer Lopez.
Tell me everything.
Well, first of all, I knew that Ashanti sang most of her songs.
Wait, what?
Ashanti, okay, so if you'll recall Ashanti, an incredible R&B singer who had hits like Foolish and Rock With Me. You don't like Ashanti, Melissa? Melissa's shaking her head at Ashanti. First of all, how dare you? Okay, so Ashanti, basically, like, she is singing most of J-Lo's songs. There's also a musician, there's also a singer named Natasha Ramos, who is a behind-the-scenes sound-alike of J-Lo, who does most of J-Lo's music. There's also, like, I went down a rabbit hole. Also, okay, there were tons. So basically, J-Lo exists because Tommy Mottola was mad at Mariah Carey. So here we go. Tommy Mottola and Mariah Carey were married. They got divorced. Mariah Carey was, like, a huge superstar. Tommy Mottola was like, okay, I need to find someone new to fuck with Mariah Carey and be, like, good, as good as Mariah Carey and compete with her. He finds J-Lo. He's like, she's an amazing dancer. He's like, great. We're going to make J-Lo a superstar. So Mariah Carey started doing songs with Ja Rule. And then Tommy Mottola would be like, okay, well, now J-Lo has to do a song with Ja Rule. But, like, J-Lo can't sing. So they had... they had all these people competing, and they would like steal songs and lyrics, and they would steal samples from Mariah Carey and all this stuff. And J-Lo is an incredibly talented performer. That's the thing. She has the charisma. She's an incredible dancer. She's has, like, a really good performer. But like most of her music is sung by other people. Justice for Ashanti. Anyway, there's tons of videos about it. The point is, I like J-Lo. I don't have any problem with her. She is not truly singing. Also, she does say the N-word in I'm Real, which makes sense when you realize the person singing is Ashanti. Okay, anyway, so now she's back together with Ben Affleck. I enjoy that. One, because it makes me think, like, you know, in 2002 when they were together, the only reason it didn't work out was because there was so much media attention on them and they were so young.
Is that true?
They said that they canceled their wedding because there was too much media frenzy and they broke up.
Oh, wow.
So I think that now they're both older, they're both matured, you know, like, and maybe they were meant to be together all along.
Yeah, I mean, I just love celebrity relationships because they make me feel better about my own life. And they, like, it humanizes them. I also, like, a big thing, like, having been left by my fiance, a big thing is always, like, oh, but, like, also all the, it's, like, looking to celebrity proves that, like, that's never a reflection of the person that was left. Like, No. The most incredible people are cheated on and left and
correct
divorced and, like, you know, and so I think it's, like, this way of humanizing them and seeing, like, oh, wait, so they can go through this and then go through that and then also be okay and then find love again.
Like, how many times was Ariana Grande engaged before she, like, found her husband?
Once?
I think a couple times.
Oh, really?
And, like, I mean, not I don't know. I love Ariana Grande's music. I don't know that much about her. I feel like it does show you, like, that life is long and complicated, right? So because they're celebrities, we've known them for so long, known, mm-hmm. quote unquote. So, like, we've seen J-Lo, like, through into her 50s. And, like, so we've seen, like, the public persona of, like, who she's been with. And everyone was like, she's going to get married to A-Rod. Like, and then, boom, out of nowhere, Bennifer's back.
Yeah. It gives you a
perspective.
It gives you perspective. It also reminds you that there's always another person. Like, right. It's very rare that, like, it's not like A-Rod and her relationship exploded and then she's just now going to be single until she dies. Like, it's always like, oh, who's around the corner? Ben Affleck's around the corner. Exciting.
Or like, she even talked shit on his tattoo. Remember when he got that big Phoenix tattoo on his back? And there's, like, interviews of her being like, it's not good. And now they're back together. So.
And just that, like, these people that even are in these, like the Jason Sudeikis, Olivia Wilde of it all has mm-hmm. been a really interesting thing where, like, so he's, you know, he's got this hit show that's, like, unbelievable. I think one of the best things he's ever done. But then his like, fiance leaves him for a much younger man.
I don't know why they split up, but I'm like, her and Harry Styles is so surprising.
Oh, it's shocking. But it's just this reminder of, like, these shocking things happen to these celebrities. Like, nobody's safe.
So you feel like, okay, so, like, if I'm watching, anything could happen to these people, then anything could happen to me.
Well, I already feel like anything could happen to me. Right. And then it's like a reminder of, like, I'm not special. Anything could happen to anybody.
Yes. That's how I feel. But I also do that with people in real life, which I think you do too, where mm-hmm. you're, like, always fascinated when someone is, like, with someone and then they get divorced and then they get back together and then they, like, fight. You're always, like, very interested in who's getting divorced. I will say that.
Oh, yeah. But it's also this thing of, like, I think it's, like, a really fun way to play with fantasy, right? Because, like, what the fuck do J-Lo and Ben Affleck talk about?
I don't know. I think I knew that they were, like, friends the whole time. Like, I think they were remained friends.
But just trying to figure out, like, what is that relationship? Like, what draws them together? Like, what is it like? Like, how often are they just, like, on the couch watching TV? Like,
why are they compatible?
Yeah, like, why are these certain people compatible? What does it look like when they go to somebody else and then they write songs about that? Like, it's all so messy and fun, and I love it.
Yeah. I saw a fun TikTok that was like, Taylor Swift knows exactly how to fuck with her specific exes based on their astrological signs. And so it'll be like, Calvin Harris is a Leo. He needs to be the center of attention. He needs to take credit for everything. And so what did she do? She came out and said that she wrote one of his biggest hits. Or that it's like, John Mayer is like a something rising, and so he needs everyone to love him. And so that's the one song that she's put out where she's been like, no, no, we're not going to let you make you guess at who this is about. This is has his first name in it. Like, and I was like, that is so funny. And also just so like, you're like, yeah, like that, like you, I don't know. It feels like you're a part of a game, even though I know it's their real lives.
Well, I think we like tend to like superhero celebrities, and then the relationships are the things that like remind us that they're just regular people in a lot of ways. Melissa, you want to come on in and share your thoughts and potential conspiracy theories? What do we rate this episode?
Okay, can I say something?
Okay. No, you can't. You can't say a thing on your own podcast, and I won't allow it.
It's okay, Gabby. You can say something.
Well, it's a tie. Earlier in this podcast, I tough loved Allison. And I just want to say that I stand by that Allison is a creative force, and that I don't like hearing her talk about herself in a way, because I find it frustrating, because I think she does have a lot of ideas. But I don't want you to feel unheard, because you kept saying you didn't feel heard. And so I want you to know that I do hear you, and I respectfully disagree.
Okay.
But this is a conversation we've gone in circles around a ton of times, because we have different approaches to art. But I just want to say that for the record, I believe Allison is an ideas powerhouse, and you will not convince me otherwise. And so I'd like to rate this 11 out of 10. We are very different people with different points of view, and isn't that why you're here listening to this show?
Thank you. Look, I think the fact that I feel like I am currently out of ideas right now, I don't take to mean that I will be out of ideas forever, or that it means I don't have any ideas, or that I'm a boring person. I think maybe you extrapolated some of that from what
I was
saying.
And then I got angry. I like invented what you were saying, and then I got angry at how dare someone say that to you, but nobody was saying that.
But nobody was really saying it.
I'm fighting myself to defend you from...
Yeah, I was just saying in this current moment... Yeah. I'm having trouble coming up with TikTok and Twitter content.
I know, and
content.
I got upset.
That to me doesn't mean that I am a garbage person. I didn't take those steps that I think you thought maybe I was taking.
Okay, I got mad. I was like, how dare you talk bad about yourself to you? It's okay.
But to me, it's also, right, it's you saying that that's me talking badly about myself, but that's implying that there's like, that me not currently feeling like I have ideas is
but
bad.
You seem
whereas
frustrated.
Like, I'm trying to look at it. It's frustrating, but I'm trying to look at it as like, you know, maybe it's just that right now I don't have that many ideas, and that doesn't need to mean that other that much more than that, if that makes
sense.
Sorry,
I'm a fix-it person. I get very heated.
It's okay. I will rate this 74 out of 72 second chance benefers.
Aww, why do we love it? Why do we care?
Melissa?
I'll rate it 10 out of 10 on air apologies and forgiveness.
All in one episode, I canceled and then uncanceled myself. Or just like, you know, if you feel like you want to like talk about what might be going on for you internally, I'm here for you.
Got it.
Thank you to Olayami Olorin for being our guest.
Just Between Us is a Forever Dog production hosted by me, Allison Raskin.
And me, Gabby Dunn.
Produced by Melissa DeMonts.
Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey.
Brendan Burns composed our killer theme music.
To listen to this podcast ad-free, sign up for Forever Dog Plus at foreverdogpodcast.com/plus.
And check out video clips of our podcast on YouTube at youtube.com/foreverdogteam or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/justbetweenusshow.
And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Forever Dog Team to keep up with all the latest Forever Dog news. Also at Allison Raskin on Instagram, at Gabby Road on Instagram, and at She Is Not Melissa on Instagram. Okay, bye!
Forever Dog!